Support for podcasting on KBIA comes from Grindstone Fitness Studio, a full-service gym offering equipment for more traditional exercise such as weight and cardiovascular training, as well as specialized classes. Choices include personal training, spinning, yoga, Pilates, and more. All classes taught by certified professionals. More information is available at 443-4447. Grindstone Fitness Studio, 3005 Chinaberry Drive in Columbia.
Wednesday, March 19th, 2014, and this is KBIA's Views of the News. Our weekly roundtable on media behaviors comes to you from the Futures Lab studio at the Reynolds Journalism Institute. I'm Amy Simons, and here with me are Missouri School of Journalism colleagues Mike McKean and Ernest Perry. On our program this week, what happened to Malaysia Flight 370? Your guess is as good as ours, theirs, anyone's, but with little to report beyond speculation, some are still giving this story wall-to-wall coverage. Just in time for the start of the NCAA tournament, ESPN launches its 538 site. Has Nate Silver struck gold once again? I'll ask our panelists. And have newsrooms become hostile places for people of faith? Some are saying so. There's a lot more we'll hopefully get to as well, but we start today with a story that gripped the Pacific Northwest yesterday. Longtime KOMO TV photographer Bill Strothman and pilot Gary Fitzner died after the station's helicopter, Air 4, crashed upon takeoff from the station's rooftop helipad. Newsroom employees say they heard the crash, ran to a balcony adjacent to the newsroom, and saw the chopper in flames. Within seconds, the ABC affiliate found itself in breaking news coverage of itself.
When we would hear the helicopter, and sometimes you and I'd be sitting here doing the news, and we'd hear the helicopter, because that helipad is just right above us here, we would be invigorated by it. We would know that something was going on, and we would wait for word to find out where Gary or Greg, our other pilot, would be flying to, what story would they cover. Sadly, sometimes it was tragedies, but very often it was just a good bird's eye view of some developing story in our community. Gary Fitzner, thank you so much for what you gave us here at KOMO.
In the morning show in particular, Gary and Bill would be after beautiful sunrises.
Yes.
You know, they had the opportunity to get some really gorgeous scenic shots and have an appreciation of our beautiful Puget Sound region that many people never get.
That clip came from yesterday about midday here, Central Time, about 4 or 5 hours after the crash. The live coverage on KOMO and several other Seattle stations went on for hours, and at times it got quite emotional. There were times you could hear anchors Dan Lewis and Molly Shen's voices cracking and tell tears weren't far away. As journalists, there are times when we become the story and we then still do have to transition into this mode and bring the story to our audience.
And I have to say, from what coverage I did see, and that was largely from the links that you put up on the blog, they did an admirable job of conveying the, you know, human emotion and still being very professional about it. I've never been in exactly that situation, but many years ago, I had to do live reports from a scene where one of our engineers had been up on one of these transmission towers, and it came down, crashed, and killed him and a few other people. And that's a tough job to do. Even if you think you can be professional, even if you're a little bit more removed than they were from their colleague, that's hard.
Yeah, it's one of those situations where you sort of have to try to divorce your feelings at that time from the story itself. And that was particularly hard for them because it happened right outside the building. I mean, it's something that they were accustomed to hearing and seeing every day was that helicopter take off. And then for the helicopter to actually crash right there on their doorstep makes it even harder. I mean, there's been a lot of, over the years, there have been a lot of tragedies involving television helicopters, television live trucks getting involved in accidents and that sort of thing. But usually it's away from the station when it happens. Mm-hmm. But this happened right outside, so that made it doubly hard for them.
Right outside, and the station is located right in downtown Seattle, right next to the Space Needle. So it was also something that was going to create major traffic delays. There was a plume of smoke that could be seen for miles and miles and miles around. Something else that I noticed yesterday in the coverage and watching some of it live was looking at King TV, KING, which is also owned by the same company as KOMO. They were using a helicopter shot in their live coverage, an aerial video from KIRO. Talk for a second or two about how some of the rules of competition between stations in a single market go out the window when one is impacted so deeply.
Well,
like this.
I mean, part of it is just simple economics. It used to be back in the heyday of local television news when they were rolling in 40-50% profits every year. Each station owned or leased its own helicopter, and now they have to do these collaborative ventures in order to make sense of the expense of it all. So that's part of it. But I do think also you do see just sort of the rallying around the profession, and you try to share resources, you try to share anything you can to tell that story when it's part of the community.
I know that Mike alluded to it was when he talked about the profit margins. Several years ago, there was a lot of conversation about whether or not having these live helicopters and doing these kinds of things was actually worth it in terms of the money. And there are some stations that have cut back on that. I mean, Mike mentioned it, that a lot of these stations, especially where you have three or four television stations in a certain market, have sort of collaborated on doing that. And I think one of the reasons why they've sort of gone to this and kept the helicopters, because it gets them to places a lot quicker, especially in heavy traffic areas. But also the public itself has become used to it. They expect to see that helicopter out there, and when there's a horrific accident or something's going on in a remote area and that sort of thing. So in those ways, they still see the need to have it. But I think from an economic standpoint, when a tragedy standpoint like we have here, they start to think again about, whoa, wait a minute, do we really need to have this?
Okay. Well, if you're anything like me, chances are you've spent at least a few minutes, maybe even hours, in the last 10 days watching the coverage of the disappearance of Malaysia Airlines Flight 370. We're no closer to knowing what really happened to the Boeing 777. All we do know for certain is that it left Kuala Lumpur and it never made it to Beijing. Did it crash? Was it hijacked? Did it land safely somewhere outside of the sight of radar? Or is it like the TV show Lost, where everyone on board is living out life on a tropical island? Your guess is as good as mine. It's as good as Mike's or as Ernest's or anyone's, really. But that's not stopping CNN from going wall-to-wall with coverage. MSNBC and Fox News are on the story, too, and the networks are still leading their nightly broadcasts with it. But there's nothing really new to report. Here's how Rush Limbaugh characterized the whole situation.
It's getting absurd now, is the point. All the conspiracy theory, you know, that thing has been hijacked, you take the seats out of that thing and you can turn it into a giant nuclear bomb, has just created this primordial soup atmosphere for conspiracy theories to just go through the roof. And it's now so far gone that the simple explanation is what's going to end up being the truth here. But nobody's going to accept it because they're so far gone now with potential theories that it's going to be difficult. People aren't going to believe the truth once it's known.
Primordial soup, Mike.
Well, I mean, there's lots of things I want to say about this. But first of all, Rush Limbaugh doesn't have any problem, and nor do any other talk show hosts traffic in conspiracy theories when it's about Obamacare or something else that's on their agenda. And I don't have a problem with CNN or the broadcast networks or anybody covering this story in depth. We care about it. Is there anything new going on? Well, I'd say maybe there are new developments. It's incremental. It's fascinating to watch, but it's like a detective story. And this is like the ultimate sort of human interest story. Why would we not want to tell it? And if you're in television news, the cable news channels, when you're trying to keep an audience with all the fragmentation that's going on out there, and you can see from the numbers coming in every hour that it's working, why wouldn't you do it?
Yeah, I think people are really interested in this because of the, I think the mystery of it. Where did this plane go? I mean, first they were saying, well, it's in this area. And then I would say, well, wait a minute, it was lost on radar when it turned. Well, wait a minute. When did it turn and which way did it turn? So it's almost like you're getting bits and pieces of it. It's almost you're talking about Lost.
Yeah.
Well, this could be a real life.
And it took,
Lost,
what, 6 years to figure
exactly,
out what really happened with Lost.
And who knows? I mean, one of the things that I found fascinating was that when they bring the experts in, which CNN has done a pretty good job of doing, they actually talk about once the coverage is over, they still don't know what happens in a lot of these accidents until 2 or 3 years later. And then you get a 30-minute or a minute report. Well, remember this accident that happened here? Well, now the NTSB has come out with this final report and it says this, which in a lot of cases is totally different from what you were getting initially.
It is fair to say that what CNN and a lot of other folks are doing, not just CNN, is just speculation. I mean, that's all we can do. They are bringing on a lot of experts to speculate with a lot of different points of view. And they're having the same kind of conversations that we're having with each other about what's going on, except they're a little better informed. And so I actually enjoy being involved in some of that speculation. On the other hand, it's fair to say they're kind of sucking the oxygen out of the room. So they're not, CNN especially, on the air is not doing much with what's going on in Ukraine.
Yeah,
they're not doing much with
a
lot of other big stories.
I mean, what's happening in Syria right now has really turned into what some people are saying it could be genocide. And that story is the third or fourth, in some cases, fifth story that you see in the block. That's where I have a problem.
But even with that, I mean, if you're the news organization, think about how people are consuming your content and even coming to it in the first place. I'm a big fan of cable television news, but do I watch it continuously? No. If I get an alert on my cell phone or my tablet that there's breaking news, then I might switch over and watch it live. If I want to find out what's going on in Ukraine or Syria or whatever, I can go to any number of news sites, including CNN's site, and there's plenty of coverage of that, just not on the air on the 24-hour cable channel.
I mean, I think what's happening is that this story, because of the mystery involved, is what's keeping it going. Whereas in the other stories, I mean, you're getting your typical news. Here's what Putin did today. Here was the reaction by the West and the United States. Here's what some of the people on the ground are saying. And then you move on to the next story. With this one, it's just a little incremental that keeps people coming in.
So we're almost 2 weeks into this. I mean, Friday, it will be 2 weeks since this plane took off. There are some who are beginning to say, and people have been critical of CNN's decision to go wall to wall with this, but there are some that are saying, okay, go wall to wall with it. We understand it's working for the ratings. That's what we're even saying here. But what about continuing to characterize this as breaking news and having that title on there?
I don't know. I mean, I think it's fair to say that we use that term very loosely in television news as it is. On the other hand, I mean, as long as there are new developments, I think it's fair to talk about them. And let's just face it. I mean, we've been 2 weeks into this story. Amelia Earhart disappeared how many decades ago? And we still talk about it. We still do documentaries about it. This is 200 and some people. And if that plane is never found with all of the technology we have today, that's really interesting.
Well, ironically, it was on CNN that we got the understanding of why it is we're so glued to the screen. Here's psychiatrist Gail Saltz telling CNN's Brian Stelter why she thinks it is we're so mesmerized by the coverage.
Even though, as you pointed out at the beginning, there's never been anything like this. It's unbelievably rare. But when you watch it over and over again, it doesn't feel that way. We tend to identify with these kinds of disasters, and so the fear of flying may go up for many people.
Yeah, at the first bump of turbulence this morning on my flight, I had that look out the window to see where I was, even though I knew it was irrational. And I'm sure that's a common feeling after coverage of a plane crash.
Just like conspiracies aren't necessarily rational. In fact, interestingly, Brian, what happens with conspiracies is that there's something called motivated skepticism, which means you already have a belief, and any evidence that comes in, you make fit your belief. So even though we may continue to get some evidence, whatever comes in, people filter it through their own prism, and they might make it fit whatever story is more comfortable for them. So for instance, if they're invested in these people being alive, then they may make the evidence fit sort of a, you know, the television show Lost scenario. Like they're somewhere on an island, they're okay. And that's understandable because it makes us less anxious.
One thing I haven't seen much in this coverage, and maybe I'm not looking in the right places, but we haven't learned much about the people who were on this plane. We've talked about the 270 some odd people who were involved here. Is that one place we're missing the boat? And I realize we are thousands of miles away, But is that something that's missing here?
Well, we got a lot of that coverage initially because they were at the airport and the reporters were there talking to their family members. So we got a lot of that. But after a while, when there was no news, that part of the story sort of got lost. And we were on the technical aspects of where could the plane be? How can we increase the search range? Those types of things.
I mean, 2/3 of the folks on the plane were Chinese, and beyond what we can get from relatives camped out at a hotel and all the anxiety that's present there, we can't really know a lot independently about them unless someone, their government or whatever, is willing to share that information about them. Ultimately, that might happen. I thought, you know, she was right. I mean, her explanation is as good as any, and certainly there is this whole notion of culture of fear that we talk about a lot. Mm-hmm. You hope people don't take from this experience the wrong lessons about flying. On the other hand, there are some really interesting lessons that journalists have, including CNN, have brought to bear. Like, you can turn off the transmission system, even the passive one that lets us know where something is. There are some airlines that don't have the same GPS capabilities as others. There are some airlines that apparently have lax policies about letting people come into the cockpit. Those things are real. That's not a culture of fear. That's not imaginary. Those are real policy issues.
I mean, we talk about transparency all the time on this show. And when I saw that, that was probably the most transparent that I've seen in terms of being inside a cockpit and what can happen and what the pilots can and can't do. And that's information that I don't think the general public has really been right. been able to see in that kind of detail ever before.
Okay. We'll keep watching as well. Millions around the globe. March Madness is in full swing. Last night, the Tigers defeated Davidson in the first round of the NIT tournament. A couple of the NCAA tournament play-in games have already been played. And tomorrow, it will be basketball from morning through the night as the big dance really gets going. So when better for ESPN to launch a new data journalism-based site, 538? In its launch, stats guru Nate Silver promised it would make news a little nerdier. While it is expected to partner with ESPN Films and Grant Land, 538 says it's more than just a sports site. So what has stood out to you in the debut this week?
Well, one of the things that stood out is that this is another opportunity for ESPN to grow the brand and to grow it in a way that will attract an audience, especially those who like the stats, those who like the numbers behind the games. This is another way for them to sort of reach out to them. But I think that there are some other issues involved here in terms of who's actually working behind the scenes at 538. We know about Nate Silver and what he's been able to do, but he's facing some criticisms because they feel like it's not as diverse. His employee base is not as diverse as it should be. And I think that that's something that not only he, but a lot of the other startups are going to need to work on.
Yeah, it was interesting because he was asked about that when I forget what the percentage was, but it's a small number of his approximately 20 employees are women. And I don't think there are any minorities working.
No, there aren't any minorities. No.
And you think about that and his answer was it was more than this. But the initial reaction was our applicant pool was mostly white males. OK, we all know that there are things you can do to improve the applicant
pool. Then cast a wider net.
Right. And get out and talk to people who are actually, because there are a lot of other startups out there and they're startups that are being done by ethnic minorities, by those in the international realm, and they've been able to find more diversity, and I think he's been able to do it. He should be able to do it too. But I think his idea is really going to help ESPN, but it's really going to be interesting to see what happens after the NCAA tournament. What are they going to be producing then? What happens in those dark days where you have only baseball? Which is stats-driven, but it's 160
Not in the same way. With the NCAA tournament.
And it doesn't reach the same audience, the same demographic.
Even people who wouldn't normally watch basketball. Everybody's in a pool, everybody has a bracket, and everybody's looking for an edge.
Frankly, I'm less interested in what 538 does in the realm of sports. I know ESPN cares about that. Than about the other areas that they say they're going to work in politics and in lifestyle news and other areas where you can apply the science of statistics, a mathematical approach where you can use infographics and big data in ways to help illuminate stories. Mm-hmm. If anybody's going to have an opportunity to really advance that part of our profession, it could be Nate Silver just because of his personal brand. and the money that ESPN is going to put behind it. And if you think about it, if folks start coming to 538 for non-sports content but can then be pointed over to ESPN, well, then that's an audience builder for them too.
It's going to be really interesting to see when he says he still wants to have a hand in politics how that's going to play out, because ESPN has not had a very good track record when it comes to being involved in politics. Usually they get burned, and I'm really surprised that they're
going to— Talk a little bit more about what you mean by that.
Well, basically when they had Rush Limbaugh on, he was doing Monday Night Football. That didn't turn out very well for them. They've had other politicians who would come on the air and talk, and it would turn off a certain segment of their audience. They want to have as large an audience as possible that stretches across a large demographic, both when you talk about socioeconomics mm-hmm. as well as political. So if he's going to go in this direction, is that going to turn off a certain segment? I think if he sticks with the numbers and a lot of what he was doing when he was in New York Times, he might be safe. But when you start going down that road, it could be a problem.
And let's just put it this way. He's not the only one who's thinking along these lines. In fact, the New York Times is going to hire a similar size staff, put a different name on it, and continue the work that he was doing. They believe in it, and a lot of other news organizations believe in data-driven journalism. I find it a little bit interesting that some of the professional critics, so to speak, are talking about things that really don't matter in the long run, whether or not the website itself is innovative enough or whether or not the first series of stories that they have on their site are weighty enough. That's all going to shake out one way or the other in the days ahead. So let's give them a little more time.
Well, I think what he and others have proven is that if you have the right kind of content, you can be successful in this kind of format. Right.
Okay. Well, the First Amendment, it's the one that gives us freedom of the press, protecting journalists from interference from an overreaching state. It also grants us freedom of religion. But there are some who say that those two don't mix so well, that newsrooms are hard places to be people of faith. For example, Fox News Channel's Lauren Ashburn says she's been told not to wear a cross on the air, a directive she's chosen to ignore. And a New York Times deputy metropolitan editor says it's hard being an evangelical Christian in that newsroom. Here's an excerpt from Michael Luau's remarks made at the King's College last week.
The Times is like a lot of other elite cultural institutions, filled with cosmopolitan, urban types, highly educated people who went to top colleges, whose cultural sensibilities are probably more shaped, you know, by the Upper West Side and Park Slope, Brooklyn, than, you know, the Bible Belt. So it's certainly not the easiest place to say you're a Christian. In fact, some of those people at that breakfast who have confided their faith in me with me at the paper have often sworn me to secrecy. And yes, it's true that I'm here today, but I did wonder, you know, how much to broadcast it. You know, Paul is telling me to like market it and like put it on my Facebook page and my Twitter feed. And so like I did put it on my Facebook page, but you know, I didn't say much about it.
So based on your experiences, are newsrooms hard places for people who are faithful?
I think a lot of it depends on what type of newsroom you're in, what area of the country you happen to be working in, and that sort of thing. I mean, newsrooms, by and large, try to have sort of a balance and not to project a certain philosophical, be it religious, political, socioeconomic, not to have any of that can be picked up in terms of biases in their stories and in their product. But I think that you have to remember that there are individuals, and individuals are going to think differently and view things differently based on where they come from, both from a religious standpoint as well as their upbringing. So I don't know if you can say that they're being that there's this sort of philosophy or sort of policy against that. But like I said, it's different from newsroom to newsroom.
I think he had a pretty good handle on sort of the interpersonal dynamics in a newsroom. And when it comes to bias in terms of religion, I'm much less concerned about it as it appears in the stories that are reported than in the ones that never do get reported mm-hmm. because those ideas don't make it through the cut in the assignment process. And I guess the other thing I'd say, just to balance that a little bit, There's a difference between the impact you can have by having your religious values, whatever those may be, influence the kinds of stories you want to see covered, and having to show I'm wearing a cross, I'm wearing, you know, a Star of David, I'm wearing a hijab, whatever it might be. Frankly, I think there could be a lot less of that sort of outward appearance and more focusing on the stories. You remember how many years ago was it that right after 9/11 when KOMU got in such a big squabble because of the flag pins. I don't think that you're showing your patriotism to your country or even thinking of ideas for stories that the public wants to hear at the time just by, you know, donning a little pin. Mm-hmm. It's much more important that you talk about the stories themselves, not the outward representation.
I mean, I think one of the knocks that journalism has, regardless whether you're talking about newspapers or television or even online, is that they don't cover religion enough in a way that it really has an impact on people's lives, where they see themselves and their religious experiences within the overarching story of who we are as Americans. And I think that's one of the knocks against journalism that I think is fair. And I think part of it is because they're afraid that they're going to get criticized by one religious faction or another because they're going to feel like they haven't received as much coverage as, say, another religion. Right. So their way of doing it is just backing off from it and not.
If you can't
it
do everybody equally, then
exactly.
try to,
exactly.
to ignore it all. Well, before we go, I want to talk about the relationship between journalists and publicists. It's a strange dance we do, looking to them for information and access, and they looking to us for positive press for their clients. The Boca Raton Tribune has decided it's done taking calls from PR agencies trying to pitch stories and even threatened on its website to block their phone numbers and emails from their servers. Now, what you can't see is that as soon as I read that, both Ernest and Mike both started chuckling and laughing over here. Why is that?
It's not going to work. because, I mean, it's their jobs. I mean, they're supposed to.
Well, it's whose job? Let's be clear about
it. I'm sorry. Okay. It's the job of PR professionals to get as much publicity as they can for their clients. And they're going to use every trick they can, every tool they can to try to make that happen. But on the other hand, it's a reporter's job to get news and information. And, you know, they're going to use those PR professionals to try to get that. Now, if you alienate them when you need them, they may not be there. So I just don't see how this is going to work.
I don't think it will work either. But you remember all the times we've talked about like Conan O'Brien, mm-hmm. for example, and making fun or Jimmy Kimmel making fun of how we use PR too much for some of the stories. Right. We use the exact same language. I think we could probably find a happy medium somewhere. For me, when I'm getting, you know, email, for example, from a publicist, what I hate are the ones that assume that they know something about me that's not true. They're really lazy. For example, when I was hosting this show before you, yeah. I'd get 3 or 4 or 5 emails a week from publicists wanting to have an author come on. We have never had an author right, on this right, show. Right, right.
I haven't gotten that yet.
If you target me with information about something that I'm personally interested in or that's relevant to the program I produce or the publication I work on, I'm much more interested in seeing that.
I know one of my favorites when I was producing a show elsewhere was, well, we've already contacted, and I know that this station, and this station is already interested in doing this story, so aren't you? Well, no, if my competition's doing it, why would I want to?
Exactly. And I think it goes back to what Mike was talking about. I mean, you have that, they're just as lazy in some cases as the journalists are. And I think this was a case where the Boca Raton paper just got tired of dealing with lazy PR professionals and decided to go nuclear on the whole thing.
I suspect there's going to be a time in the not too distant future where the same technologies that allow us to deliver ads that are targeted at individuals or news stories that are targeted at the things you like, PR professionals are going to figure out how to target their messages at journalists more effectively too.
I agree.
Well, that music means we're pretty much out of time for this week. I'd like to thank you for spending the last half hour with us. You can read more about the topics we talked about today. Check out our links blog. You can find it under the talk shows tab at kbia.org. Like us on Facebook or follow us on Twitter. Our handle is Views on KBIA. These are all great ways to watch and listen to our program again. Leave us comments or questions and see previews of what we'll be talking about next time and more. Our thanks to RJI's Travis McMillan for directing today's show and Pat Akers for handling the audio. I'm Amy Simons. We're taking a short break next week, but be sure to join us again April 2nd when we're back with you for another edition of Views of the News.